great about Friday? Everything. Including Live Music Friday on WKAR. That's Chris Rollins playing the guitar, Hank Horton on bass. Their buddy TJ Wolf is going to be along in a little while. Hank, Chris, and TJ are here for Current State Live Music Friday today. Hank and Chris are music instructors at Marshall Music. Well, they will have an open house on Saturday. They'll be there. I'll be there. I hope you'll be there, too. And we're going to hear more music and speak with them a little bit later here today on Current State. I'm Peter Warfin for Mark Bayshore. We'll hear music by Vivaldi in a little bit from, we'll hear about the Kalamazoo Symphony playing music by the Red Priest, Antonio Vivaldi. We'll talk about a new firearms training club in Jackson County here in mid-Michigan and much more here on Current State on WKAR. A recent study released explores the impact of Asian carp and what that might have on Lake Erie. The analysis by the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor found that if the fish made its way into the lake, it could eventually make up one-third of the fish weight of the lake. The project, which used computer modeling, went on to look at likely impacts of that many carp. Some are less destructive than anticipated, though. Current State's Mark Bayshore asked study co-author Dr. Ed Rutherford to explain the importance of fish weight and why this kind of measurement is so critical.
Well, it's important in that you can translate fish weight into numbers of individuals if you knew what the average weight of the fish was. But because the model that we used tracked the dynamics of fish in terms of their biomass or their weight, that's why we reported it as such. But really, what I guess the take-home message is that it's a lot of fish. One out of every 3 pounds of fish in the lake would be Asian carp.
Is it common for researchers to use that metric?
Well, we wanted to have a basis of comparison with where Asian carp are already established in the Illinois and Mississippi River. And there are reports from agency surveys there that indicate that those Asian carp species comprise from 80 to 90% of the fish weight in certain areas of those rivers. So compare that with 33% of the fish community is Asian carp in Lake Erie is what we're projecting. So on a relative basis, we think both the effect and the density of Asian carp will be lower in Lake Erie than what has been observed in the Illinois and Mississippi rivers.
Talk to us some more about the major impacts, though. If it reached that point, one-third of all fish weight, what would the major impacts be?
Well, these two species of Asian carp, the big head and silver carp, are plankton feeders. So they feed at the bottom of the food web on phytoplankton, which are tiny plants, and zooplankton, which are tiny animals or water fleas that feed on the plants. And these are the first foods for young fish. They are also the primary foods for older stages of some plankton-eating fish, which are prey for more desirable species such as the walleye or the rainbow trout. And so because Asian carp, we're predicting, will outcompete some of the plankton-eating fish already in the lake for plankton, those species will decline, and the prey available for walleye and other predator fish will also decline.
Could it eliminate any species?
No, we're not predicting that it would eliminate any species. We're predicting that it would have an effect. Most species we're predicting will decline in weight, in total population weight, by less than 25%. However, there are a few species we're predicting would decline as much as 35 to 37%, and those are the plankton-eating fish that would compete directly with Asian carp for food.
I know you are working with some economists here as well. when they get wind of stats like that, of a decline in commercially important species like walleye and others, what do they tend to make of it? Have they had a chance to analyze the economic impact of that decline?
Actually, our colleagues out at the University of Wyoming, David Finoff and Travis Swarzyniak, who's at the Forest Service in Colorado, and his graduate student, Jenny Apriesnig, have done such an economic analysis of the U.S. recreational fishery in Lake Erie and how the economics of it would change in response to our prediction of the Asian carp invasion. And even though a species like walleye we're predicting would decline by about 10 to 15%, which is a relatively low number, the value of walleye is high enough that it can result in a significant economic change in the economics and the value of the fishery.
Your report also says, and I'll quote here, lake-wide impacts of the Lake Erie food web will not be as great as some have feared, unquote. Tell us more about what that means.
Well, if you talk to folks around the Great Lakes, at least the ones that I've talked to, you tend to hear two different opinions. One is that there won't be any impact by Asian carp because much of the Great Lakes is not suitable feeding habitat for them. And the other opinion is it will be really severe and we should do everything we can to keep them out. And I think what our study has shown, at least in terms of the science, and when you consider the whole food web, even such a high biomass of Asian carp will have significant impacts, but not at the level that some people have feared.
We're talking with Dr. Ed Rutherford. He is a research fishery biologist at the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory in Ann Arbor. He just wrapped up a study that found that if Asian carp make their way into Lake Erie, they could eventually account for a third of the fish weight of that lake. But we're also talking about other findings in that survey. You've pointed out that Lake Erie is biologically a very productive system. What do you mean by that, and why is that important?
Well, what we mean by that is that there are a lot of nutrients flowing into Lake Erie. It's the shallowest of the Great Lakes. It's the warmest of the Great Lakes. And when you combine those conditions together, you have a good recipe for high productivity or high abundance of lower trophic level organisms such as phytoplankton and zooplankton. And so there's lots of food for fish to eat. And so the diversity of fish and the density of fish in Lake Erie is also higher than in any of the other Great Lakes. There are in habitats within some of the other Great Lakes, such as Green Bay or Saginaw Bay, that are also shallower and warmer than the main basin habitats, and they also are very productive. There's lots of food, and the density of fish in those environments are high. And because Asian carp are feeding at the bottom of the food web, given the habitat for reproduction, there's likely going to be more food available to them to feed on, and they should do better.
Well, overall, does that reduce the negative impacts of Asian carp in Lake Erie, the fact that Lake Erie is biologically very productive?
Well, that's a really good question. When you look at other invasive species, such as the quagga mussel and the zebra mussel, that have invaded Lake Erie, as well as the other three of the other Great Lakes, not Lake Superior so much, typically their biomass gets higher in Lake Erie because there's more material to eat, but the relative effects on the food web that have been observed are not quite as great. We know that in the Illinois and Mississippi rivers, the amount of nutrients flowing in there is higher than it is in Lake Erie, but the makeup of the food web and the numbers of predators available also is important. So in Lake Erie, there are more predators of young Asian carp than there are in the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. And we think that's why the density of Asian carp has gotten higher in those rivers compared to what we think it would be in Lake Erie.
In your study, you also write about the potential impact of Asian carp on lakes Michigan and Superior, and you suggest that the impact would likely be relatively even less there than on Lake Erie. Can you tell us why?
Well, it's in the main basin habitats of Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. So we think the impact would be less because there's less food available for, there's less plankton available now in Lake Michigan and in Lake Superior than there certainly is in Lake Erie. So there's less material for the fish to feed on and grow and reproduce.
I understand you're continuing this kind of work on Lake Michigan and on Lake Huron. Do you have any hunches as to what you'll learn about those two?
Yes, we're already sort of engaged in working on that, and we're trying to run a comparison where we use the same initial starting conditions, but of course the food web differs in those different lakes, and the amount of nutrients and phytoplankton differs in those different lakes. So we think that, you know, sort of following along this idea that the higher the amount of food, the better the Asian carp will do. We think we will see that Asian carp will not become as abundant in either the main basin of Lake Huron or Lake Michigan as they would in Lake Erie.
As a non-scientist, I find it surprising, and I imagine other people do probably as well, that, you know, some species of Asian carp reach weights of 30 to 40 pounds on average. Several of them get even a lot bigger. It seems surprising to me that a carp can get so big, some species of carp can get so big eating only plankton and not consuming other fish. Why is that?
Well, if you could see the same thing in mammals or even in the great whales. The largest animal in the oceans is the blue whale, and it eats very small organisms. It eats krill, and elephants eat vegetation. It's just much more abundant. And if the animal can digest it and break it down and utilize that, because there's more food available, and it's probably easier to capture. It allows less energy going into hunting and processing, and more energy into growth.
That's an awful lot of organism to maintain, though, on pretty small food. There must be an awful lot of it.
Well, there's both a lot of it, and the reproductive capacity and the ability to replace themselves is higher among organisms that are smaller. So that also helps explain the availability and production of organisms at the lowest trophic levels.
Dr. Ed Rutherford's a research fishery biologist at the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor. We've been talking about his most recent study, which concluded that if Asian carp make their way into Lake Erie, they could eventually account for a third of the fish weight in that lake. Dr. Rutherford, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
For Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore.
How Insensitive, not the playing, the tune by Antonio Carlos Jobim. All we needed was Astrud Gilberto, and it would just be perfect. No, that was super, super tasty. Hank Horton on the bass, Chris Rollins playing the guitar with that classic samba. They're going to be at Marshall Music, where Hank and Chris are music instructors, with an open house tomorrow. Hope you can be there. We're going to hear from their friend and student, TJ Wolf, coming up in just a minute. Did you know that was based, Jamie Paisley, loosely based on the Nocturne No. 4 by Frédéric Chopin?
Well, I mean, if you're going to choose somebody to borrow from, Chopin's a good choice.
I just looked that up. I didn't know it, but there it is. Current state here on WKAR. I'm Peter Wharf in for Mark Bayshore. What we think of as Western classical music stretches back hundreds of years, a millennium or so, and it can be challenging to know where classical music starts, right?
Yeah, but who's counting about how long that lasts?
But who's counting? That's right. That's what we always say. Current State's fine arts reporter Jamie Paisley here is here right now, and he's going to tell us about Maestro Raymond Harvey from the Kalamazoo Symphony and what they're going to be focusing on coming up.
Yeah, this Sunday they got a concert called The World of Vivaldi. It's, you know, based on that wildly popular Baroque composer. I mean, he was famous to the point where he had essentially a tour guide about him. He was a living composer at the time, and people said, if you want to go to Venice, go see Vivaldi. That's right. How popular he was in his time. And so that's who Maestro Harvey is going to be exploring this Sunday. And to Maestro Harvey, exploring that is one of the great things about this concert series in Kalamazoo.
You know that this is part of a long-running series, The World Of, where we've presented the world of a certain composer, exploring his life, his times, his relation to society when he lived, and also a lot of his music. And I'm proud of the fact that we've done, by my count, 24 different composers. We've never repeated one. And so it's quite a legacy of different composers and insights into their lives, and sometimes some of their more unusual music. And many of the things that the Kalamazoo Symphony is doing now, we've evolved these activities over the years. I can trace back to what was the original version of a type of concert that we found a better way to present. So they've been works in progress, and I think we've hit upon a season that our community and our audiences really, really enjoy.
And for each of the Kalamazoo Symphony's World Of series, music director Raymond Harvey tells me he starts from scratch researching each of the composer's lives.
What's interesting is finding the dirt, you know, finding the little personal details or the relationships with other people around the time. Those are the fun things. It takes a lot of work on my part because not only do I want to be informative, but I want to present it in a way that's entertaining. We have slide images up on the screen. I often have props or little costumes. It's a little bit of everything. I like to say that this is an education concert, like a children's concert for adults. One of the beauties of it is that the people that come to these concerts, and many of them are our regular classical subscribers, they are always enthralled, and they always say they learned something. They learned something new, and they had a good time learning it. So that's really mission accomplished.
Exactly, exactly. Because there's a lot of, when you think about the term classical music, it's very daunting, I think, to the public at large, and this kind of helps break that down a bit, which is always
right.
A good mission.
Right. And some people that I've talked to after the World Of concerts have actually said to me this is the first symphonic concert they'd ever been to. They were nervous about coming, but this seemed like the perfect choice. It's an afternoon concert. It's only 90 minutes long. It has more than just the playing of the music. So it's a great entree to get into this whole symphonic concert world and get a teaser about what it's about.
So during this last trove of deep digging into Vivaldi's life, what's the nitty-gritty of his past that you really like and latched onto this time?
Well, you know, his nickname was the Red Priest. He was ordained as a Catholic priest when he was 25 years old, but basically didn't do any priestly duties because music took up his time instead. And he was called the Red Priest because he had bright red hair. I thought about putting on a red wig, but I don't think I will for this concert. it's interesting to explore how his early life led him to do what he did. He got a permanent position teaching at an orphanage, teaching music and conducting the orchestra. And because of that, he had stability in his life and stability of a salary, which allowed him to then spend his time composing and not worrying about where he was going to get his next meal.
The program for this Sunday's Kalamazoo Symphony Concert, exploring the life of Vivaldi, contains rather loose terms for those pieces used. It's a convention very common to that world of the Baroque era, and of Vivaldi in particular.
Things that were called concertos, things that were called sinfonias, things that were called overtures. In that time, many of those terms were interchangeable. And also, Vivaldi was very good at borrowing from himself. One of the pieces that we're doing, which is called a sinfonia, is actually the overture to one of his operas. So he did a lot of self-borrowing. People always wanted to hear something new, and so if you could pass it off as at least having a new title, they were happy.
As you may know, I'm one of the newer faces and voices here in mid-Michigan, so I asked Maestro Harvey to describe a bit of Kalamazoo, the city that he's called home for the past 17 years and 17 seasons with the Kalamazoo Symphony.
First of all, Kalamazoo as a city is marvelous. It's one of these well-kept secrets. It's in a part of the state that has a lot of artistic energy. It's a small city with arts-rich ideas. The amount of activity that goes on here is really quite amazing. And I have to say, I'm a New Yorker originally, New York City, and I'd lived in the Midwest, I'd lived in California, I'd lived in lots of places in the United States. And some 17 years ago, when it was proposed that I should take a careful look at Kalamazoo Symphony, of course I thought they were crazy. But I'm very glad that I did. It is really quite an exceptional place.
So you spoke earlier about being from New York, and from what I understand, you were also a bit of a Broadway fiend as well. Could you have, or did you debate going into kind of Broadway as a career?
Oh, no, I never debated going into it myself. Of course, my sister and I, when we were teenagers, thought we would write the next great Broadway musical, and that lasted for about 3 days, and we gave up. But I was living and born in New York and loved the theater, I just was a Broadway fanatic. I went to every Broadway show I could. I had standing rooms when I couldn't afford a seat. I went to the public library and took out Broadway scores and played through them on the piano. And it's funny how those things stay with you. There are so many Broadway show tunes that I know every single word to now, years later. They just don't leave you. But that was great fun. And it was important, in retrospect, to have a sense of theater, to have a sense of the stage and drama as you grow as a classical musician. A lot of what I do is about drama, is about storytelling. And so to grow up with that as a part of my background is actually very useful. ¶¶
We're speaking with Maestro Raymond Harvey, music director of the Kalamazoo Symphony, about this Sunday afternoon's World of Vivaldi concert at Western Michigan University. And it wouldn't be a survey of Vivaldi music without a little of the Four Seasons. Is that the so-called big finish for this weekend's concert?
We're including autumn and winter from the Four Seasons as part of the program. The way it works out, we're actually going to end the program with the double trumpet concerto, which is a somewhat more flashy ending. The soloist, though, you may have seen from the website for the two Four Seasons movements or concerti, are graduate violin students at Western Michigan University. So it's a nice chance to feature this young talent in a setting like this.
And they're splitting the two.
One is doing autumn, and one is doing winter.
And I think you did that, in my research, you did something like that a few years ago. You did all Four Seasons with four different solos, yeah?
Yes, on our regular symphonic series subscription concert, we did all Four Seasons with a different soloist for each season. And each of the soloists there had a relationship to Kalamazoo. One, for instance, was the violin professor at Western Michigan University. One was a marvelous young violinist who's gone on to specialize in Baroque violin, and she's from Kalamazoo. She grew up here. Another was the son of the previous music director, and he's an associate concertmaster down in Florida. And the fourth one was our then current concertmaster. So it was nice to feature all four of them. They were pleased that no one of them had to do the whole thing. And it was nice to have four soloists that were terrific and that had a connection to the community.
Maestro Raymond Harvey, music director of the Kalamazoo Symphony and a tour guide for this Sunday's World of Vivaldi concert. So, Maestro Harvey, are you starting to craft next season's concert and those individuals you're going to choose for the next World of series?
Yes, but if I told you, I'd have to kill you. It's not been announced yet.
Then
you have to wait.
Mum is the word. You can join Maestro Raymond Harvey and the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra to explore the world of Vivaldi this Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. in the Dalton Recital Hall at Western Michigan University. Tickets and more information available online at kalamazoosymphony.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Current State here on WKAR with some of winter from the Four Seasons. I guess it's still that, though it doesn't really feel like it today, but it should on Sunday, I hear. Peter Wharf in for Mark Bayshore today here on WKAR. The World Watch Tuesday as President Barack Obama shed tears as he announced a new executive order aimed at curbing gun violence in America. The plan includes an overhaul of federal background checks and increased access to mental health care. Mr. Obama's mandate has spurred gun sales in recent days, and many of those buyers are women. Women are the fastest growing segment of gun owners in the U.S. My next guests have co-founded a local chapter of a national organization that encourages women to be responsible gun owners. Marcy Jankovic and Vanessa Molnix have started a chapter of the Well-Armed Woman, or TWA, as it's known, in Jackson, Michigan. Marcy and Vanessa, thanks for coming to Current State today.
Thanks for having us, Peter.
Thank you.
We've been talking to you about the Well-Armed Woman before our interview today, Marcy. How did this start as a national organization?
Carrie Lightfoot, out in Phoenix, Arizona, noticed that the firearm industry is very male-dominated, and women have different issues when it comes to carrying concealed weapons for, and our bodies are different. We've noticed that things like holsters take on a different take when you're female as opposed to male. And there are many, many issues in a male-dominated industry that didn't reach to women. So women were hesitant to step out. And she founded the Well-Armed Woman in order to address that need and educate, empower, and equip women to be responsible gun owners.
Right. You got different, obviously, body issues, yeah. Clothing issues. And
even yeah. Stance can be different.
Mm. How's that?
Well, the center of gravity is a little different.
Mm-hmm. Right. Makes sense. Is there any affiliation with the National Rifle Association?
We like them. They're good friends, mm-hmm. but no, we're not affiliated.
Okay. Yeah. What prompted you to found the local chapter in Jackson? What really started it for you?
Vanessa and I were working on a Second Amendment event. Both of us have our carry concealed pistol permits. Mm-hmm. And we were discussing how there's a need for more training once you receive that credential. And there didn't seem to be many opportunities to do that. We don't have an indoor gun range in Jackson County. There didn't seem to be anything organized. And I was doing some research one day, and the TWA website popped up, and I immediately sent that link to Vanessa, and we discussed it and said, gee, we need this in Jackson. We found out there were 9 other chapters across Michigan, and the organization does very well at assisting you in starting a local chapter.
How do they do that?
They provide all kinds of support, from forms that you need to fill out, from not just forms, but press releases. Mm-hmm. Everything you need is there on the chapter leader website, right down to all of the financial considerations of running a chapter, which is all handled through the national office. Dues are $50 for a year, and from those dues, they then return monies to the chapter for banners, flyers, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And they have the banners, flyers, and those kinds of things all designed for you that you can customize.
You get everything from creating awareness to the nuts and bolts of running the business.
Yeah, yeah. And running your Facebook page.
Marcy, let's ask Vanessa now, who's on the phone, Vanessa Mulnix. Vanessa, how long have you been a gun owner, and what's the appeal for you? Self-defense? Do you enjoy target shooting? What is it?
Well, I had my license. I got it a little over a year ago, and I took my first class probably 2 years ago. And I think the incentive for me was the realization that I can protect myself, or that is at least an option. And I didn't grow up in a gun world, so I had kind of the mindset that this is something to be afraid of. And when I came to the realization that I was able to actually help protect myself, my family, that was kind of the turning point for me to reach out and get the training that was necessary. It's a big responsibility, so it's not something you take lightly. And so I think that was the appeal for me.
Marcy and Vanessa, let's talk a little bit about background checks. In the last month, 2 significant actions have taken place on this front. In December, the Michigan State Police took over the duty of issuing CPLs, concealed pistol licenses, to applicants. Previously, that had been done by local county boards. And this week, President Obama issued an executive order to tighten background checks for firearm sales. What are your takes on these measures? First, I'll ask Marcy.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give legal advice, but I would note that in Michigan, we've always had background checks. We don't have the issues that that the president brought up in terms of gun sales, because background checks are done. If you order a firearm on the internet, it is sent to a licensed firearms dealer for you to pick up. It doesn't come to you by the UPS fellow. Background checks, I think, miss the point. if the president was serious about reducing gun violence, one thing he could do immediately with an executive order is mandate that the U.S. attorneys stop plea bargaining away the felony firearms charge that they're entitled to bring, and note that during the Obama administration, when they do bring it, which is only 40% of the time that they could, when they do bring it, the conviction rate has gone down 15% because that's an easy thing to plea bargain away. If you want guns out of the hands of criminals, that's one positive step we could take that he didn't discuss from what I heard in his speech. And we would like to see that. The background check, like I said, it's done in Michigan, so it doesn't really reach to us until you start looking at how is this going to be used nationally? Is it going to be used to develop a national database to take away guns? Veterans and senior citizens already see that perhaps their names are going to be put on a list through NCIS and then fail the background check from some arbitrary bureaucratic decision that you have no due process rights over.
Let's check in with Vanessa. What are your thoughts, Vanessa, on the change in the issuing of CPLs in Michigan and the call for tighter background checks, Vanessa?
Well, I think the change in how the CPLs are issued will provide broader appeal. I shouldn't say appeal, but availability to those people that are wanting to carry and get the education and training that they need for that. So I think it probably eases that, makes it a little easier process for people. As it relates to the background checks, I really don't have enough information on, you know, I haven't read the executive order to be able to comment on that piece of it. I do think that, you know, women especially, but all people have a right to self-defense. And so anything that would hinder someone's ability to that constitutional right could be dangerous.
Marcy, let me ask you to wrap things up here on this broad discussion. What type of turnout are you expecting or hoping for when you have your first chapter meeting at the Brooklyn Sportsman's Club in Brooklyn, Michigan?
Well, I think we're getting a pretty good response. I don't know how many people will show up. I didn't look last night to count how many have registered so far. I do know that when the first chapter in Michigan opened up in Holland, Michigan, 80 women showed up for that first meeting. A lot of people are going to come to the first meeting. Is not a shooting event. The first meeting is to talk about who we are and what we're trying to accomplish. And so I think maybe some people will show up and decide that they don't want to participate. Subsequently, meetings will be an hour. They're 2 hours long, the third Saturday of every month. And we will spend 1 hour on education, perhaps learning about holsters, perhaps learning about the Castle Doctrine, and an hour with supervised shooting by an NRA instructor.
Very good. We've been talking about the creation of a new chapter of a national organization. The Well-Armed Woman is dedicated to the safe use of firearms by women. Marcy Jankovic and Vanessa Molnix are the co-founders of the new chapter in Jackson, the 10th so far in the state of Michigan. Vanessa, Marcy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you,
appreciate
Peter.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Current State on WKAR. It's Live Music Friday here on 90.5 FM. And really enjoying, I hope along with you, I'm sure, Hank Horton and Chris Rollins of Marshall Music. I have a student with them today. He plays the guitar. He's going to sing for us, too. It's Timothy Wolfe with the tune Gray Street by Dave Matthews.
How she listens, and she said nothing of what she thinks. She just goes stumbling through her memories, staring out onto Gray Street. And she thinks, hey, how did I come to this? I'd dream myself a million times around the world, but I can't get out of this place. Oh, there's a loneliness inside her, and she'll do anything to fill it in. But all the colors mix together to gray, and it breaks her heart. Oh, she wishes it was different. She prays to God most every night, and though she swears he doesn't listen, there's still a hope in her he might. She says, I pray. Oh, my prayers, they fall on deaf ears. Am I supposed to take it on myself to get out of this place? Oh, there's a loneliness inside her, and she'll do anything to fill it in. And though it's red blood bleeding from her now, felt like cold blue ice in her heart, she feels like kicking out all the windows and setting fire to this life. She would change everything about her, using colors bold and bright, but all the colors mixed together to gray, and it breaks her heart. It breaks her heart to gray.
Yeah, TJ Wolf with a tune by Dave Matthews, Gray Skies, here on Current State on WKAR. It's Live Music Friday here on 90.5. Peter Wharf in for Mark Bayshore. We're going to speak with TJ and also Hank Horton and Chris Rollins from Marshall Music. TJ, thanks for singing and playing today. How long have you been doing that?
Well, I've been playing guitar for... well, since I'm 18,
yeah.
But I just started singing 5 months ago.
No way.
Really? Yeah. This is a pipe dream for me.
You've studied with Hank for 5 months, but surely you've been.
No. Yeah. No, I came to him and I hadn't sang.
Wow.
Probably anything ever.
Really?
And and I told him that it was a kind of a bucket list thing for me to do an open mic, and he's very convincing and a very, very strong teacher. I've been really blessed to have good people in my life, and he has really helped me and given me these kind of opportunities. So if you're out there and you're looking for vocal lessons, he's good.
TJ Wolf singing for us here on WKAR. Hank Horton, you're at Marshall Music. What was your road there in 30 seconds or so?
I'm sorry. What
was your road to Marshall Music? Kind of give us your elevator resume there.
Oh well, I actually taught there back in the '80s when I was in grad school at State.
Right.
And then left and went on the road and worked with Styx and Dennis DeYoung and lots of other people.
You were in Chicago for 25 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And back here, and I still play with people in Chicago and New York, and play with Showdown here, and play with the Lansing Symphony, the Jackson Symphony, Battle Creek. I sub in with those. I teach at Marshall's. I do sessions. I do this show.
Yeah. Chris, you are at Marshall Music, too. You've got dozens of students. What do you do there?
Teaching there every day of the week. I teach also at Lance Community College and at Olivet College, too. I teach in various styles of like classical guitar, jazz, basic rock and roll.
Right.
Adults, kids, and we have adult rock bands in there, too. I run those also.
How long have you been playing the guitar?
Oh, forever.
Forever.
30 years, yeah.
Yeah. Hank, what's going on this Saturday?
Tomorrow we have the open house at Marshall Music. We started it last year. It was a huge success.
in no small part to being on this show, because I polled a lot of people who were there,
right,
and lots of them heard us. So we have the open house. It's from 3 to 5 tomorrow. We're going to have an instrument petting zoo, which all the kids and adults like. They can pick up a stringed instrument, a brass instrument, a woodwind instrument. We'll show you how to play it. We're going to have a lot of instructors and students playing. We're going to give away 1, 2, and 3 months lesson packages in a raffle. And people that sign up for lessons tomorrow, we're going to waive the registration fee we normally have. And we're going to have lots of, you know, refreshments.
Yeah, nice.
And nice weather.
Looks that way. Good thing you're not doing it Sunday.
And just one quick word about Timothy.
Yeah.
Except for one student recital, this is his first public performance ever. So nothing like getting thrown into the deep end of the pool, right?
It's amazing. You were only singing for, I don't know, 5 to 10,000 people.
Oh, as I said, you know he can be very, very convincing.
Give me a quick look at the extent of teaching activity at Marshall Music. What's the student body there?
Well, we have over 400 students. We have about 30 instructors. We teach all the instruments that we sell, band and orchestra instruments. And somebody wanted accordion lessons, so I found an accordion instructor. And so we teach, you know, just about anything that you could imagine. And we have lessons 6 days a week. We have a lot of age ranges from 6 or 7 up to 70 or 80. Last year we had a young student here. I thought it would be good to have an adult student this time because a large portion of our student body is adult students.
Right. Hank Horton, Chris Rollins will be members of the teaching staff at Marshall Music in Lansing coming up tomorrow with their open house from 3 to 5. Is that right? 3 to 5?
Yes.
3 to 5 p.m. Marshall Music will host that open house. We've also heard from one of their music students, Timothy Wolf, with his radio debut today. At the open house, you can learn more about their programs, try out instruments, and hear performances by instructors and students. Thanks, guys, for being here today. That was fantastic. What are you going to take us out with? Are we going to do the samba or?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Very good. It's Hank Horton on the bass again and guitarist Chris Rollins.